Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, checklist for a second go at the Persian Gulf. Depose the dictator, destroy the weapons, secure the oil. In all the debate over an American-led invasion of Iraq, the talk has rarely turned to crude. But the vast pool of oil that sprawls in such abundance beneath Iraq's mountains and deserts could well be the ultimate war spoil for a nation that can't get enough of it. You can bet the Bush administration has done the math. America consumes more oil than any country in the world. Iraq's oil reserves are second in size only to Saudi Arabia's. Turning on the Iraqi tap could weaken OPEC's stranglehold on world oil prices. It might also be America's best chance to meet projections of soaring demand. We're talking tonight about the oil factor in war on Iraq. Could the promise of oil be greasing the skids for war? Does America need Iraq's oil under control? Will war win the prize? Will war win the prize of oil security? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from London is Vijay Vaithiswaran, environment and energy correspondent for The Economist and author of the forthcoming Power to the People, a book on the future of energy to be published next year by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Also joining me from London is Yusuf Ibrahim, Senior Fellow and Manager of Strategic Planning for the Morris R. Greenberg Center of Geoeconomic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good evening, Yusuf Ibrahim.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. And good evening, Vijay Vaithiswaran.
Good evening.
It's good to have you with us. Also with us from the studios, from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Good to have you with us. Vijay, if you would help us start out here, how does oil factor into this American ramp to war, and what is at stake in Iraq and in the Middle East on the oil front?
It's quite interesting that George Bush and his circle of closest advisors have rarely mentioned oil. This is, in some ways, the two-ton elephant in the living room that nobody's talking about.
Almost an invisible issue.
Well, I think the reason is, unlike a decade ago when his father took on Saddam Hussein during the Gulf War, when there was actually more open talk about oil, I think that both the president and the vice president, being from the energy industry, have learned the hard way not to talk about their links too much, lest it look suspect. I think they're going out of their way not to mention oil. But frankly, in my opinion, I think it's inevitable. There's going to be repercussions. Some will be good, some will be bad. And it has to be better to discuss it openly and try to figure out what the implications are going to be rather than pretend as though oil is an irrelevant factor.
I guess when we look at the Middle East, we know it's there, and it's there in superabundance. But talk to us in particular about Iraq's oil, Vijay Vaithiswaran.
The great story about Iraq is that in some ways it's the dog that's not biting. It has enormous reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia. Yet at the same time, it's producing virtually no oil at the moment. And that has a lot to do with UN sanctions and also to do with Saddam Hussein's attempts to get around those sanctions. Other countries in the world, Iraq is not free just to produce oil and ship it to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Under UN sanctions, there are very strict rules on what can be done, and this is part of a way of controlling the UN thought. Oil for food. It was meant to be a control on Saddam Hussein. In fact, what's happened is he slips a lot of oil through illicit channels to his neighbors or in tanker caravans, as they're called, and also uses oil as a political weapon in an unobvious way. He'll suddenly shut off the taps and give no oil to the world market in an effort to rattle his cages in a bit and make his friends or former friends in OPEC never quite know what he's going to get up to, and that gives him extra leverage on the world stage.
But it's not pumping nearly as much oil as it might. If we imagine for a moment a longer-term future in the Middle East, where Saddam is currently, but George Bush would like to see him not at some point in power, how important is Middle Eastern oil to the United States long-term?
The short answer is, in the short term, the world can live without Iraqi oil. In fact, it has whenever he's turned off his taps, and without hardly a blip. Other countries make up the shortfall. Saudi Arabia is one of them that makes up the shortfall, and they make the extra profits. But in the long term, my argument is the world will become increasingly reliant on oil from the Middle East, particularly from Saudi Arabia and Iraq, which have very, very large reserves and very cheap oil to bring out.
More dependent even than the world is today, than the United States is today, when
absolutely.
It's already very dependent?
No question about that. And that's chiefly because that's where a lot of the oil is, and it's also where the cheap oil is. Going up to the Arctic or in Siberia or the deep waters off the Gulf of Mexico, that gets oil men very excited, but that's very expensive oil. It costs $10 or more a barrel to get that oil, the high technology, all that's required. The old saying in the industry goes, if you go to Saudi Arabia or Iraq, you stick a straw in the ground and the oil comes out. Mm. It's a dollar or two per barrel. And so it's very cheap oil, by and large. There may be a lot more in Iraq, some people speculate, than is even on the official record books.
Yusuf Ibrahim,
if that's not true, it's an enormous amount of oil.
Yusuf Ibrahim, if I may turn to you. So there we have it, a long-term and growing, not diminishing, dependence on Middle Eastern oil, we're told. How does that leave Iraq's oil figuring into Washington's planning and view of the war that we may be facing right now? In your view, is it a factor? Does it grease the skids? Does it tip the scales to war?
Well, we have said, some people in this administration have said that it was one of the primary reasons. What we want is a very cheap oil pumping station, cheaper than and bigger than Saudi Arabia. So it's not exactly a secret. And then, of course, after they said that, they figured that was not the political thing to say. Right now, we are striving very hard to find another reason to go to war against Iraq, which is, of course, that it is supporting al-Qaeda. And I think we're kind of making all kinds of awkward effort to prove that. But I think it is absolutely true that oil is a factor, and furthermore, that if you just factor in the need of China for oil, the way China is developing right now, and if you look at the big picture, look over 20 years, the world simply will need more oil, because in the next 20 years, it is unlikely that we will find a means, a substitute to oil for transportation, for example. There is really not another substitute that can take the place of oil.
So, Yusuf Ibrahim, I guess we know that the need for oil is going to go on, but now we've got a war sitting right in front of us, and I guess what I'm pushing at is how big a kind of side dish, a kind of secondary advantage to a potential U.S. military dominance, at least for a while, of Iraq, is oil? Is this a prize that you think Washington is looking at as a secondary or more than secondary benefit of regime change in Baghdad?
Yes. Well, if you look back, you know, over 50 years, and if you look, in fact, at some of the rationale that was behind the 1990 war, which has finally been released, some of the top secret paper, there was no question that oil security and the control of the United States of the oil resources in the Middle East were a driving engine behind the 1990 move against Iraq. It hasn't changed, and traditionally the United States has always wanted to be the power that is in control of the Middle East oil. This is something that has irritated the hell out of the French, for example, for many years, and they have tried very, very hard to have a cut in there, the British too, of course, and if you look at all the deals that the Iraqis have been making in the past 10 years with other parties, they have concentrated very heavily on the Russians and they've concentrated very heavily on the French. Of course, the assumption is Saddam Hussein was going to be in power. The sanctions would be one day lifted, and then the French and the Russians would be rewarded amply, and the Americans would not have any share of that pie. I am not so sure that these things have not made their way back to the White House and to the CIA, and they're all part of the reasoning why it is absolutely essential to, A, change that regime, B, put a friendly regime in place, and C, turn it into our primary pumping station in order to balance it against Saudi Arabia and, of course, in order to balance it against OPEC. Now, whether this is going to happen is another story.
I want to bring Jack Beatty in. Jack, this is quite a vista being opened up, and I guess at some level, we all know this in our gut. The oil is there. The need is enormous. But this is the motivation that is not described. We've heard a lot about weapons of mass destruction, a lot about a dictator in Baghdad, and there they both sit, and both, we're told, very real. Here's another big motivator.
Yes, and it's one that goes right to the heart of American life. You know, you could, you know, the movie Traffic, which showed the drug war and the addiction of Americans to drugs went from the highest in our society to crime in Mexico. Well, you could make a similar film called Oil, and it would begin with Joe and Mary getting into their SUVs in the morning and driving their 50 miles to their air-conditioned offices, etc., and going about their day with all the travel. You know, you could then show people in our military and the military establishment and how big it has to be as a result of this. You would then show a Saudi Arabian government that officially supports a religion, Wahhabist, the Wahhabist variant of Islam, that preaches hatred against us. You'd show that religion infecting the minds of people like Mohammed Atta and others. You'd show them getting on the plane, and you'd show them finally the invasion of Iraq. You'd show them the dead civilians. You'd show them perhaps you'd even give a taste into the future, and you'd show them the men in the veterans' hospitals years from now, and that would be the price we're paying for oil.
That's the successor movie to Traffic, as imagined by Jack Beatty. Vijay Vithaswaran, what about it? Can a war on Iraq deliver the prize? Can you imagine a post-war scenario in which American sway or even control over Iraq's oil is vastly increased and thereby America's oil security is vastly increased?
Here's how the scenario goes for those that hope it happens. The argument is that any regime that comes after Saddam is going to need money to rebuild. And so, of course, the only recourse they have is to pump out the oil. If it's a U.S.-friendly regime, they may pull out of OPEC under pressure from George Bush and company. Billions of dollars from the U.S. oil majors, the French, the Russians, will come pouring in. All this, goes the argument, will produce this wonderful gusher that will keep American SUVs riding with cheap oil. Even if that happens, though, my argument is that it's going to take at least 5 years before you can turn around this dilapidated heap that is the Iraqi oil industry.
Does it really matter if it takes 5 years? There's a long oil timeline here. We're going to have a need for a long time.
Absolutely. And that's a good question to ask. And that's 5 years just to bring it back to its previous levels. In order to go on and challenge, say, Saudi Arabia for the supremacy of OPEC and to throw open the taps. Well, there are a couple other reasons why this may not happen, and you can tell I'm quite skeptical about this. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like the Holy Grail. I think it's incredibly alluring, but very, very difficult to get your hands on it. The any regime that comes, investors are not foolish. They're going to want to know that the rule of law is going to be respected, contracts. There may be regional instability as a result of an invasion. We don't know what the Pan-Arab effects will be from an invasion of Iraq. And The trickiest point is even a democratic country that's installed by the U.S. may say, thank you very much, Uncle Sam, but in our own national interest, we're going to stick with OPEC, and we're going to keep prices high. Now, let's not forget that Nigeria, Venezuela are countries that are within OPEC, and they are democracies of a sort. Mexico and Norway, they're not even in OPEC. They're our friends, but they collude with OPEC to keep prices high.
Vijay Vithaswaran, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about the oil factor sitting behind the drive to war in Iraq. How big a motivating factor for war this time is oil? And does the U.S. economy, as it is, require greater U.S. sway over Iraqi oil? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the oil factor in all the discussion of war with Iraq. Our guests tonight are Vijay Vithaswaran. He's environment and energy correspondent for The Economist, also author of the forthcoming Power to the People, a book on the future of energy. And Yousef Ibrahim, former correspondent in the Middle East for The New York Times and now senior fellow in Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. You can join the conversation as well. How big a motivating factor for war this time is oil? And if Iraq didn't have oil, would we be hearing as much about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction? Is the promise of oil greasing the skids for war with Iraq? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Yousef Ibrahim, you heard Vijay describe the Bush administration's, as he imagines it, the prospect of access to oil and perhaps control over oil on the other side of a successful campaign, military campaign in Iraq. Can you see that unfolding as it might be imagined?
Well, first, I'd like to elaborate on what he said because he's absolutely right. The even if we prevail issue is very important. My first assignment for the New York Times, in fact, was Iran, and I arrived there 4 months before the Iranian Revolution. Mm-hmm. And that was the last regime change we have provoked in the region. At that point, the Carter administration had reached a conclusion that the Shah had to go. And our chiefs of staff and senior generals were visiting Tehran every day to convince the Iranian army to let go. And finally, we did contribute to that regime change.
But was this a push for oil? Is that the point you're making?
I'm sorry?
But was this a push for oil? Is that the connection here?
No, but it was a regime change that we did prove of, and we didn't think much about the oil at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The very first move that Ayatollah Khomeini made was to cut the Iranian oil production by half, from 6 million barrels a day to 3 million barrels a day, and if you recall, it provoked world economic crisis. Then it was Iran at the time thought the Shah was squandering the national wealth by pumping all this oil. In Iraq, we are making two assumptions. One of them is correct. The other one may not be correct.
All right.
It is absolutely correct that the Iraqi people probably would be extremely happy to get rid of Saddam Hussein. It will be a very joyful day, the day we get rid of him, and if we succeed, they will indeed greet us with open arms.
And the second?
But the second assumption that it means that they love us might be a wrong assumption. Iraq has suffered for 11 years from sanctions, which are widely seen in Iraq as having hurt the Iraqi people. In those 11 years, I think sentiment toward America has not been as warm as we like to think it is.
Are you suggesting there that even a military victory or a successful military campaign might not secure Iraqi oil for U.S. markets?
I'm suggesting in the long run it will not do that for that reason and for the other reason that was just pointed out, which is it is not in the national interest of Iraq or any important producer of oil to bring down the price of oil. That's completely crazy. Why would they want to do that? Why would they want to be our pumping station at the expense of bringing down the general price of oil? It is historical that big powers that have oil will drift towards OPEC.
But I guess the question is, Vijay Vithaswaran, on the other side of this operation, and again, presuming that it happens and presuming that it's successful, could the United States be in a position, either politically or militarily, to secure Iraqi oil supplies for U.S. markets?
Short of a military occupation of the sort the U.S. had in Japan, I find it pretty hard to believe.
Of course, we're hearing just such an occupation described as a possibility.
Well, in the long term, we talked about that the first few years will be needed to rebuild the industry. Mm-hmm. The U.S. may be around for nation building. But if we're really telling the U.S. doesn't run Japan today, Japan does what it wants. Mm-hmm. And likewise, if you talk the long term, what does this mean for the big prize in oil? And would an independent, democratic Iraq really want to go for being America's supplier of oil at a dollar a gallon for the rest of eternity? I have to say that's a pretty questionable assumption, especially when you look at what the likelihood of the market is. In the next 20, 30 years, demand is going to grow from many parts of the developing world. The U.S. demand looks to grow unchecked. And the place where the oil is, where God put the oil, the problem isn't scarcity. There's lots of oil. Mm-hmm. The problem is concentration. And so much of it is concentrated in the Middle East that as we run out of non-OPEC oil, or at least of cheap sources of non-OPEC oil, you're going to give a lot more market power to Saudi and Iraq. That's inevitable.
So
there's only one real way to break that, in my opinion, mm-hmm. And that is to start at home. Unless the U.S. and other consuming countries do a lot more to encourage non-oil ways of moving our cars and buses, that means perhaps things like hydrogen energy and fuel cells. There are other options out there that are at the moment quite far from market. Unless you encourage that, we're going to be stuck on oil for a long time, and that means we're going to be stuck with the Middle East.
But you know that the Bush administration is densely populated with oil men, with high-ranking officials, right up to the president and vice president who came up through the oil industry, and they're probably thinking in terms of oil. Do you think they could imagine this move on Iraq as a long-term enhancer of U.S. access to Mideast oil?
I think that's... As Ibrahim pointed out, I think that is very much part of their thinking. And, you know, I made the optimistic case of how a regime change would lead to an Iraqi government that needs oil, it needs oil revenue. And I think if you make the very optimistic assumption that there's going to be stability in the Middle East as a result of a U.S. invasion, that if you kick out Saddam, you get rid of the destabilizing factor, and you have peace and joy and stability in the Middle East, well, under that kind of a scenario, you can see how there might be more investment in the region, more oil coming that might keep the oil markets well lubricated. I question some of those assumptions, frankly.
We're talking tonight about the oil factor behind the conversation on war in Iraq. Can America secure Middle Eastern oil through military action? Is it too cynical to ask about the oil factor, or is it the heart of the matter? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, we've heard a fair amount on this show from conservatives, from hawks in Washington, who have a fairly optimistic view about the prospects for a very different Middle East on the other side of a conflict in Iraq. That would seem to suggest, according to Vijay's view, that they are factoring in the possibility of that pumping station.
Yes, in Vietnam, Henry Kissinger fouled the language with the phrase the Nun Gap. And the Nun Gap was the interval of time that would elapse between when the last U.S. soldier left Saigon and the first nun was raped in the North Vietnamese assault on South Vietnam. We wanted to make the Nun Gap as wide as possible. I tell you, in this war, the Halliburton Gap is going to be very short indeed. Even as the telegrams will be going out saying, we regret to inform you, even as that's happening, I'll bet you Halliburton and ExxonMobil and the rest of them will be making their deals with the new regime in Iraq. And Americans will have to face the fact that to support a way of life that's environmentally dubious, we have perpetrated a war.
but Jack, isn't there such a thing as a natural resource of such value that a nation has to look at it in strategic and even military terms?
Well, it has to if it has a government that, number one, says that conservation, Dick Cheney has said it, is a matter of personal virtue. It's nothing to do with national policy. They have to have it if they have a government that says, you know, at the Johannesburg summit, no, sorry, we're not going to do renewables. That's for somebody else. They have to have oil if they have a government whose whole policy is to produce more and more oil. And above all, they have to have it if they have a government that says no to CAFE standards for automobiles. Oh, no. And a government that says, hey, our CO2 emissions can grow with the economy. That's how we'll defeat global warming, by producing more global warming.
And yet there's a voting public that's pretty fond of those cars. Let's turn to our callers. Kevin's calling from Fall River, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes. I think what Jack Beattie's pointing to now is very, very important. We shouldn't make the mistake of conflating the oil industry's interest in profit maximization with necessarily the economic, I mean, beside the ethical and moral questions of law, it's not even equated with the economic interests of the American people.
How so, Kevin?
The defense budget is approaching $400 billion a year. I think it's fair to say the majority of it now is being spent because of the Persian Gulf to protect those interests. That's a market distortion. Unlike the analogy that Jack made about the drug running, I agree with all that analogy, but I would add a different point where there's a differentiation. We don't spend a couple of hundred billion dollars a year to keep the drugs coming in. That is a subsidy to the oil company. We pay a dollar something a gallon on gas, but the reality is about half our federal income tax, Social Security, Medicare is covered by FICA, about half our federal income tax goes to the defense budget.
And you see that as part and parcel of
subsidy to the oil company. We're
walking the beat in the Middle East.
Because we have to pay that tax no matter what, even if we don't consume it, we don't even drive a car. So when we go and buy a gallon of gas, well, I'm going to pay a buck something because that money is already a sunk cost. We've already spent that money on our taxes, irrespective of our consumption.
We got it, Kevin. Let me put that to our guest, Kevin. Well, I think we've lost you. Kevin, thanks for your call. Vijay Viteswaran, what about this issue of long-term dependence on oil? Even if the United States went to the maximum on environmentally friendly technologies, how great is the dependence on Middle Eastern oil going to be for how long? And do we need a friendly Middle East, a friendly Iraq, or a Middle East and Iraq vulnerable to American sway to keep that oil flowing?
There are two ways to answer that question. The first is that for the next 20 to 30 years, the U.S. economy is going to run on oil. There's no question about it. You can build all the windmills you want in the world. Unless there's a new combination of technologies that can replace the internal combustion engine and gasoline, this is the iron nexus that's kept the century going and has created enormous amounts of wealth for the United States. Until that is transformed to something else, we're going to need oil. And so that's one point, and we might as well learn to live with it and accept the fact that we're going to grow more reliant on the Middle East. That should actually encourage us to do the second step a lot faster, and that is find ways to encourage that move off of oil in the internal combustion engine. The question is, how do you do this? You know, do you pick winners? Do you say, okay, fuel cells, that's what we want, or some other kind of snazzy technology? My answer is actually the government doesn't know. It can't possibly know what the winner is going to be. But what you can do is in a way that's very compatible with free markets, say, look, what's the problem? The problem with oil is there's a premium for the environment, right? Climate change. There's a premium for human health because we know it does harm. And there's a premium for energy security. What that means is, and the caller made a very eloquent point, but I wish I could ask him, would he be willing to accept a heavy taxation on gasoline that reflected the cost to the environment and of energy security?
Of course, the caller's point was, in some dimension, that we're already paying a kind of tax in the defense budget that's required to make Americans feel they have more control over
the oil picture globally. He was right to point out that's a very murky kind of tax and it's not very transparent.
You're talking about a much more straightforward one.
But make it very straightforward. And what that would do is that way people would actually gauge their usage. People might not buy the SUV. Manufacturers might make a lot more hybrid and more efficient cars. You have the worst of both worlds today where we pay that tax in the form of taxes that go to the military, but we don't change our behavior and we don't send the signals to the marketplace to innovate with cleaner technologies.
We're talking tonight about the oil factor. How big a motivating factor for war this time is oil? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Stephen's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you. I just would like to bring up the point about whether, in fact, the amount of oil that we're going to get out of Iraq is really that significant anyway. I've read that global production of oil is going to peak perhaps between 2008, 2004 and 2008. And I just wonder why we're even pursuing this course when it's going to be perhaps sooner rather than later that we're going to need to go to renewable energy anyway.
Let's check that with our guests, and thanks for your call, Stephen. Vijay Vithaswaran, what about the peak in oil production? When is it likely to come? And if you could, paint the picture for us of how oil in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Russia interact. They're all huge players.
Sure. The answer to the caller, oil is a non-renewable resource. At some point, it's going to run out. And more importantly, at some point, we're going to surpass the halfway point of how much is left. And that's a very important threshold. But most people that look at this question are convinced that the resource base, we still have another good 20, 30 years before we get to that point where we need to feel like, oh, my God, the oil is running out. We'd better start riding bicycles tomorrow. Now, that's not to say we shouldn't start looking for alternatives, but I make the point that alarmists have been saying for 30 years, 40 years, that the oil is going to run out tomorrow. What these people generally discount is the amazing pace of technological innovation. The rocket science that's in the oil industry is absolutely breathtaking, and going out to, you know, 5-mile deep drilling at all sorts of twists and turns, going under the ocean, going into the Siberian Arctic, it's astonishing. I've been out in some of these oil rigs, and the technology there is breathtaking, but it's also very expensive. What that means is we're probably going to tap a lot more oil than the pessimistic forecast suggests. But the day of reckoning will eventually come. And so better to prepare now, I say. While you keep doing that, all that gee whiz oil that's coming in from the Siberian tundra, make sure you have a backup plan. Start getting your non-oil alternatives in gear. That's my argument.
And Yusuf Ibrahim, let me put to you the question about the Saudis, the Iraq, and Russia. How do these three huge oil reservoirs interact when you look at the future?
Well, let's not forget a very important player, Iran, which is part of that quartet. Now, to put it bluntly, if you look at Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, these three countries basically are sitting on 2/3 of the world's oil reserves. And we are on friendly term. Or we were on friendly terms with one of them, Saudi Arabia. The relationship seems to be rather rocky these days. We're about to go to war against the other, Iraq, in the hope of turning it into our pumping station. And we have declared Iran an axis of evil countries. Now, a lot of our pundits have been saying for quite some time, hey, we don't need these guys. We got Russia. Russia is the newcomer in the oil game. And the reason for this is Russia, in fact, has been increasing its exports to the world oil market. Mm-hmm. Last year, they exported an extra 400,000 barrels a day. I think they're going to do
it
again this year.
Yusuf Ibrahim, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been great having you on. Thanks for being with us. Yusuf Ibrahim is Senior Fellow in Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and Manager of Strategic Planning for the Morse R. Greenberg Center for Geoeconomic Studies. We're talking tonight about the oil factor in and around the talk of war in Iraq. Does the U.S. economy, as it is, require greater U.S. sway over Iraqi oil? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the oil factor in consideration of war with Iraq. Our guest tonight is Vijay Vithaswaran. He's environment and energy correspondent for The Economist, joining us tonight from London. You can join the conversation as well. Can America secure Middle Eastern oil through military action? Is it too cynical to ask about the oil factor, or is it at the heart of the matter? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Peter's calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Welcome, Peter. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is that every time the slightest thing happens in the Middle East, the price at the pump 24 hours later goes up a nickel or a dime, and then as soon as the issue is resolved, it doesn't go back down that nickel or dime. Concern is that we have a war in Iraq and a very unstable situation. The gas is going to double again the way it did in 1990. But even if we get control, they're not going to bring the prices down to where they are today or where they were 10 years ago.
So you're concerned that even if there's greater sway, there's not going to be a lower price. But we're hearing, on the other hand, Peter, that low prices in the United States may be part of the problem, may keep us addicted to oil.
That may be the case, but I guess my question is that it's the same type of thing that why would OPEC or why would a stable Iraq lower the price of oil as a favor to the United States? Why would the oil companies selling oil in the United States lower the price of oil simply because they've got a really good source of it coming from Iraq?
It's a good question. Thanks for calling, Peter. Vijay, beyond the access to oil, there's the issue of price. How do you see that going forward in the midst of war, after war, and in your frame of 5 years on, if Iraq's pumps are really humming and a lot of oil is coming out, would that seriously, significantly affect the price of oil one way or another globally?
Sure. I'm very sympathetic to Peter's question. It sounded like he was calling from his car, to judge by the noise in the background. Hmm. And I remember driving around Boston and parts thereabouts myself some years ago and thinking, my God, whenever there's some kind of problem, these companies really jack up the prices, and they're very slow to bring them back down. From the point of view of the consumer, but you can see that that seems to happen a lot. And undoubtedly, there is, let's just say, some extra profit-taking. Companies are quick to cover themselves in the case of something like a war premium like we have in the marketplace now, and maybe a little slower to bring down the prices afterward. But the point I would make, now looking at it from the top, sort of an industry analysis perspective to Peter, is, well, actually, the $1.50 a gallon that we pay for gasoline in the U.S., let's say just before this talk of war in Iraq heated up the prices one more time, Americans complain whenever prices go over a dollar a gallon. But in real terms, if you adjust for inflation, that's about half what it was a few decades ago. So, the cars our parents used to drive around in, those folks were actually paying more for their gasoline in inflation-adjusted terms. So I would keep it in perspective.
There you go, Peter. But I'm still not sure, Vijay, if you're suggesting that on the other side of war we would continue to have that kind of relatively level price when adjusted for inflation, or...
No, I think the one bet that you can make about the oil markets going forward is that they're going to be volatile. There are lots of reasons. Some of them have to do with war and what might happen in a turbulent post-Iraq scenario. But there are other structural reasons as well for why the industry is becoming more volatile. If you just look in the last few years, what's happened on the international oil markets is there's been a huge roller coaster. Prices collapsed down to $10 a barrel a couple of years ago, and then now the past couple of years they've been shooting up at $30 a barrel. Now, what this means is this is a very high cost that is paid by people who carry inventories, by refiners, and ultimately by consumers.
But isn't this partly about the Saudis trying to discipline the price of oil and using their vast oil reserves to do that? If Iraq's oil comes online, does this diminish the power of the Saudis in the oil world? Does it diminish the dependence of the United States on Saudi Arabia's oil?
That's the great unknown, and you put your finger on the right question. What's going to be the future dynamic of a post-Saddam Iraq and Saudi Arabia? Now, at the moment, you might think, gosh, Saudi Arabia is this tyrant on its doorstep. He took over Kuwait. He would have taken over Saudi Arabia if he could have 10 years ago. This is a guy, obviously, you'd think the Saudis would be happy to be rid of. But actually, if you look at their realpolitik actions, the Saudis are very happy for Saddam to sit in his box. What's the reason? The reason is, as long as he's in Iraq, Iraq is not a threat to them on the oil market. He can rattle his cage, he can turn off his oil, the Saudis just make up the difference and take the extra profit. Whereas if you get some other kind of regime under some optimistic scenario, that's when things get very nerve-wracking for the Saudis. So that's why you haven't seen a lot of support from the Saudis for their good friends in the United States coming in and kicking out the neighborhood bully boy. They've actually made life very difficult for the U.S.
But given the tensions in that relationship recently, one can easily imagine Washington being extra interested in an alternative. Phil's calling from Lewenburg, Massachusetts. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking on this topic. I was calling to say I find myself a lot more in agreement with Jack than with your guests on the ultimate outcome.
In what dimension, Phil?
In particular, when your guests had mentioned that the U.S. has no particular long-term way of controlling oil prices or the oil flow from Iraq, I think from all the signs that the occupation is intended to last about as long as the oil does.
That's a long time, Phil.
Yeah, it's 40 to 50 years is what I hear. But I think this is much more about oil change than regime change.
And you see an American footprint there for as long as it takes to secure that oil.
Yeah, I do. And part I'm led to that by this the confluence in the present administration of, as you mentioned, the oil company executives on the one hand, and as another show you did recently about those so-called hawks that are interested in applying American pressure and projecting American power throughout the world. And boy, those two aims dovetail very nicely.
It's a potent brew, isn't it, Phil? Thanks for your call. Vijay, what about it? The thought keeps coming up that even as long as it may be, we're on a path toward sometime in this century, oil getting scarce, and that the U.S. might have an interest in putting down military stakes now to secure that oil access long term in Iraq. Is that just pie in the sky thinking?
Well, I don't know if it's a pie. I might use a somewhat less sweet and less favorable analogy myself. I if you think Afghanistan is a tough place to nation build, you don't want to take on Iraq. It's what it seems to me, given the global realities. Now, maybe the caller is right. Maybe the U.S. military is going to be in Iraq for the next 50 years running a police state. I don't know that the U.S. Electorate would put up with that being so blatant. And if it wasn't so blatant, if it was some sort of puppet regime or a U.S.-friendly regime, in this day and age, they're going to go with their economic interest. So I'm skeptical about that argument. More broadly, though, I think the question of what happens 30, 40, 50 years, what does the U.S. do to secure its oil? The one point that we haven't talked about yet is oil is actually a fungible global commodity. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is the U.S. securing oil is, in this day and age, it won't mean anything unless all of the U.S. allies also secure oil. Can you imagine, for example, if some threat comes up that all of Europe is cut off from oil, or Japan, and the U.S. sits by and says, ah, too bad for you, I'm going to take that last barrel.
It just doesn't work, does it?
This is not the nature of the last superpower, the great American empire, as it's being called in Washington now quite openly. And if you accept that analogy of the caller that the U.S. is projecting its military might overseas, a benevolent American empire like in the early days of the Roman Empire, well, you're going to make sure your friends are taken care of. And what that means is ensuring enough oil for the global market. I think that's consistently been the case. And so wherever there's a disruption, you might say the U.S. military is going to be there to make sure a country like Japan that's 100% reliant on imports, they have no oil, and Europe, which is largely reliant on imports, we're going to make sure our friends are taken care of, and therefore simply making sure there's barrels for the U.S. isn't enough, and that's a much, much bigger task when you say, how do you take care of all of NATO?
But it's still a big project, and maybe a project with a military element, maybe not. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Juan is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Juan. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks.
I am calling because I understand how much dependent we're on foreign oil, but we usually look just to the Middle East when we worry about oil.
Yes.
And I think that we have oil to the south of the United States. Mexico and Venezuela are major oil producers. Actually, Venezuela is working a deal with the United States to sell oil at probably 5 million barrels a day. And even with like a fixed cost of oil to the United States.
Right. Venezuela has really wanted to pump up its oil production. Juan, let's put that to Vijay Vichaswaran, and thanks for your call. Vijay, what about it? Can we look elsewhere other than the Middle East for serious answers to the full dimension of U.S. oil intake?
Short answer, no. This is one of the great myths in the oil debate is somehow getting your oil from Alaska or Mexico makes it somehow cheaper or more better for the American consumer. Now, the idea of diversifying your suppliers, that's a very good idea. You know, you never want to get 100% of anything from one supplier. So, great, Mexico, Venezuela, Arctic, I say, you know, diversify as much as you can. But if you really push the argument, you say, look, Venezuela's our friend, Mexico's our friend, you know, aren't they going to somehow be better to get our oil from there? Those guys charge the same for their oil as anyone else in the global market. And in fact, Venezuela is the linchpin of OPEC, which keeps prices much, much higher than they would be in a free market. And Mexico, when push comes to shove, joins hands with OPEC. It may be our friend in NAFTA, but when oil prices started to go down, they sat down at the table and said, hey, Venezuela, Saudi, let's cut a deal in the back door. We'll join you in cutting our production to jack up the prices.
So it doesn't keep the prices.
This is the real business of oil. And even our dear friends in Mexico and Venezuela, they're going to charge a market price.
Their smaller supplies, it ultimately circles back to the Middle East. Jack Beattie, I hear this tension in the conversation. On the one hand, the notion that you raise that there is a mindset and the means to go after oil via military, maybe even via war. On the other hand, both of our guests tonight saying the complexities in the Middle East make very unlikely that any power could sit perpetually on top of that oil, just surrounding oil wells with tanks, and effectively assure an oil supply for itself or for the world.
Yeah, but I think that's a faulty model. I mean, ExxonMobil, Halliburton, these other countries, they are multinational companies. Mm. They get their money by sending the oil anywhere. It's naive to assume that we're just doing this for our consumers. This is about our big oil interests who sell oil everywhere,
everywhere. Yeah, but even taking that, can they get what they might dream of via military intervention?
Well, you know, look at the U.S. record. We're still in Europe. We're still in Korea. We're still in Bosnia. We're still in Japan. Long time ago after those wars. Now, do you think that if we have a war there and this country starts to come apart, we're not going to be sitting there one way or another with a puppet government into the next decade? It would be passing strange if we weren't. I mean, just because of the problems that will arise. And, you know, even looking at it non-cynically, suppose they really do want to build a democracy. Well, that's going to take so much work, so many tax dollars, so much investment. We're going to be there for a long, that's what they're keeping out of this, how long the end game is. I mean, there's no exit strategy, it seems to me, we're going to have proconsuls ruling there for a long, long time. And whether we get cheaper oil or not doesn't matter. Our companies are going to be doing fine.
Vijay Viswaswaran, last thought. Donald Rumsfeld has said that he's looked forward to reconstructing Iraq with the wealth of Iraq's own oil. You can easily imagine a linkage between the military invasion, between the rebuilding and the necessity of oil wealth for that rebuilding, and the United States sticking around to make sure it happens. Are you so sure that we couldn't see a Korea scenario, a Japan, a Europe scenario with long-term U.S. troop presence influencing Iraq's oil production and where it goes?
I certainly hope not. It might happen, but I think the costs of that, as it becomes clear to American taxpayers and American voters, and also the moral quandary that presents, I like to think and dream of a better America than that.
Vijay Viswaswaran, it's been great having you with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining us at this late hour in London.
My pleasure.
Vijay Viswaswaran is environment and energy correspondent for The Economist. He's author of the forthcoming Power to the People, a book on the future of energy, published next year by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Jack Beattie, there's a very dappled view of what may come. Our oil man, Vijay, says he doesn't think that America is that kind of international power.
Well, people didn't think that after the Second World War either. People didn't think that we were the Romans, that we came and we just stayed under the generations. But we have. We've adapted to that.
Well, Iraq is next on the dance card. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.
Support for